Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and this is the Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. Hugh, how are you today?
Oh, it's been quite the day. You know, a lot of people think we move up north to live the simple life, but you know this, Robert. Sometimes being simple isn't that easy, especially for a guy with my type of energy. So I got a lot on the frying pan right now, but of course, running dogs is number one on the list.
I hear you. And, you know, I understand that you were out already this morning, this afternoon, training your dogs with a 25-mile run. Is that normal for you this early in the season to jump right out there and get those long runs?
I've, you know, been on and off training now for over a month now, so that's 25 miles really isn't that big a deal at all. It's not like I'm really pushing them that hard. We stop quite a bit, and, you know, it's more just a fun walk in the park is the way I look at it. I'm not really that big on miles. I'm more about time and harness. Certain dogs obviously need a little bit more time on the trail than others. So primarily this time of year, I'm running the younger dogs a little bit more than the older ones. And, you know, just keeping them happy, showing them new sights. It's great here. We're doing a lot of exploring of new trails. So it's been a lot of fun checking out not only new trails, but new dogs in lead and discovering a lot of dogs with a lot of potential. So it's been really exciting.
So how is the snow up there in Tok?
Oh, you know, not that much, maybe 4 or 5 inches. But I was visiting with my buddy Jesse Holmes, who's another musher, used to live up in Eagle, and now he's down there in the Nana train. And he was telling me a good story about Bill Cotter, who's, you know, won the Quest and a fairly well-known musher in the long-distance arena. And Bill Cotter once was with him at a restaurant, and he unfolded a napkin, and he showed it to Jesse, and he said, "This is how much snow I need on the ground to get my sled out." And that's the way I feel, too. I mean, you have to do it in a responsible way and be cautious, but there's just such a funner experience being on a sled than on a four-wheeler. And I think most mushers would back me up on that.
Well, when you say you have to be cautious, tell our listeners, possibly very novice mushers, what that it means exactly. When you say you have to be careful, are you more careful with the dog's feet, the attitude, the mental toughness? What are you looking for?
I'm looking for places to hook off to, man. When you have that much energy in a team, you want safety first. So I've got a lot of nice small spruce trees along the trail that I can hook off low to. You know, we're only running a 12-dog team. I got a double sled. Like I said earlier, Eric, the handler, is a big boy, so he's a good anchor. And, you know, it's a totally flat, safe trail. No other traffic on it that I can tell of besides squirrels and the like. But not, you know, everybody is probably people, a lot of people would think it's a bit dangerous, but, you know, I've been doing this for quite a while now, so I've got it down to a bit of an art. I mean, I've been, even when I was up in Coldfoot 9-10 years ago, I was running with hardly any snow at all. If you have an older veteran team possibly that knows the ropes and a little bit more mellow, but never am I going out there on my own, that's for sure. I definitely believe in the buddy system. And I definitely think that you can tell a lot more about a dog pulling and their energy from behind a sled than you can from behind a four-wheeler.
Is there any difference in equipment that you use in the early season versus later on when there's much more snow, the dogs are more prepared? Are you using like a training type sled, or are you using just pretty much one sled over and over from here on out?
No. As my Athabascan friend Curtis Earhart would say, you betcha. I'm definitely not using the fanciest sleds on the block, just in case, you know, you cut a corner and clip a tree or something. I'll save the you know, multi-$1,000 sleds for the racing season or when we get a little bit more snow here. And plus, when I start doing some of our longer treks here in the next few weeks, when we start going other places, I'm going to definitely have a big toboggan sled to haul supplies and food and all that.
You know, when you and I spoke at the Iditarod last year, you said that you like to keep pretty much one sled the entire race, if at all possible. I know that the rules allow you to have more than one. Why do you go with just that one sled that you typically use?
That is for Iditarod. For the Quest, you can't replace your sled or else you're going to get a hefty time penalty. But some folks like to get down to the tiny little, you know, almost like a kid sled for that, the push on the coast. But if anybody knows my sled at all, it's one of the smaller sleds to start off the race with anyways. It's just basically a mid-distance sled. I don't really use a seat anymore. So I don't really feel the necessity to go to a smaller sled because I already have quite a small sled as it is. But I do send one out to Unalakleet, you know, just in case there's emergency situations. But if I had a bigger sled like in the past, I would switch out. But I haven't had to recently just because I go with a mid-distance sled the whole way. And that can be, you know, interesting packing-wise, especially in the Quest where you have some long runs. But that's, you know, that's where experience comes in and knowing how to be thrifty and knowing how to, you know, pack the sled properly.
Is that a strategy or is it more of just your liking with that particular sled? You know, you're, excuse me, you're a smaller guy, so you don't have to have the great big, you know, toboggan type, Iditarod type sled. Is it something more of a strategy or just a preference?
I don't, to tell you the truth, with some of these small kids like Pete Kaiser nowadays, I don't feel that I'm that small anymore. I'm about 175, which I think for a musher is probably a little bit above average. You know how mushers are fairly small people. Almost like a jockey in some respects. That's the beauty of what John Baker did being a big boy last year is, you know, he showed that anybody can do it. But I definitely think in the long run that weight does pay, is going to, you know, figure into how you perform on the trail. So I could possibly use a bigger sled and I've thought about it, but it's all sleds handle differently. So sometimes, say, 5 foot baskets or 5 foot sled's going to actually glide better on the trail than a basket sled, say, if you're going through an area outside of Calpag where it's typically really a lot of moguls and a lot of bumps. You might actually want a little bit longer of a sled. So you want, you know, a sled that you're comfortable with. And I just found a sled that I like to you know, play with out there. That being said, every year I'm always experimenting with different sleds.
Well, speaking of playing, I know you spend a heck of a lot of time every day in the dog yard, and I know that's one subject that you want to cover today. What do you want to tell our listeners about your dog yard? I know last week you mentioned how you have it set up with several pens and dogs are loose and the girls are messing with the boys. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, an exercise area as well as a housing area. What do you want to talk about in your dog yard, Hugh?
It's a little bit more mellow and toque where I leave the yard here. There's a pen right next to the where we leave at, so I can actually throw some dogs loose in that pen before we leave, and then as we're hooking up the team, I can have some team dogs hooked out in the team, and then I just have to open up the gate of the pen, and the rest of them will be in their harnesses already, and they'll just come right up to the line, and we hook them all in, and away we go. It's really all about efficiency and safety. As far as the dog yard goes, I try to keep the litters all together, you know, so they're all getting to play with their brothers and sisters. Obviously there's some dogs that are a little bit more, socially, shy, and I'll try to keep them over, not in the main center of the yard where they're going to have a lot of action around them. But what I really, was getting at there was just, you know, the more time you put into your dogs, the more they're going to give themselves for you is a saying among most of us. And that being said, you know, every day up until a week ago, they're just, you know, it wasn't getting too cold yet. So they're primarily getting red paw kibble and with a little bit of fish oil and maybe a little bit of fat. But now that we're starting to do longer runs, I'm cooking for them fish. And then we have some chicken as well. And just noticing their appetites and how they're just diving into the food just by cooking for them. I would advocate that for any musher, whether you have a big kennel or a small kennel. Cook up some food for your dogs, and just that stew, that broth, I think, encourages them to have a healthier appetite, and you're less likely to have finicky dogs. And that's obviously a big part of dog mushing. It's a lot about how good a cook you are. As well as a good masseuse as well. I mean, after the runs, we're out there massaging up their legs and their shoulders and just giving them a lot of love. Just can't be all about hooking them up, running them, putting them away, and going back in the house to warm up. Should be out there with the dogs and spending a lot of time with them. And I try to make it where there's less of the dogs pulling people around. So when we're done with the run, I'll let two or three loose at a time, just, you know, for safety reasons, and bring them back to their houses and let them just run back free and let them decide to come back to the house. And they're all trained that way, and they all do quite well that way. It's a lot less stress on them as well as your handler.
You know, speaking of time in the dog yard, I know a big difference between even mid-distance and long-distance mushers is how long that you guys spend in your yards. If you think about a recreational musher, typically they don't spend a whole lot of time in their dog yards. Typically some of those guys just have three or four dogs in their backyard, in their neighborhood. Can you give our listeners, especially, again, those novice guys or those recreational teams, how long Iditarod guys, you know, long-distance type mushers, Yukon Quest, whichever, are spending per day in their yard? Is it hour upon hour, or is it just, you know, two or three times a day, an hour at a time?
I'd say on average 4 to 5 hours at least. I was up in Kotzebue a few years back visiting my buddy John Baker's house there over by the airport, and he had a really nice setup. I mean, right outside his kitchen, he just opened the door and there were his dogs right there. It's the same setup at the place here in Tok. I can look right out the living room window and, you know, they're almost a part of you. But John had a great saying that he told me. I asked him, it was in the springtime, and I said, so this time of year, John, how many times a day do you feed your dogs? Twice? And he just looked at me. He said, at least, Hugh, the more time I spend with my dogs, the better, don't you think? Mm. And that's why I really respect John, and I enjoy talking with him because he's always trying to teach you, and that's the beauty of a guy like him. And the way I am right now, I'm probably feeding 4 or 5 times a day. Not big meals, but, you know, I've got broth meals and snacks, and then you have your big meals as well.
So with the dog yard, a lot of the long-distance guys have handlers. Can you tell us a little bit about that? You know, there's different ways that everybody does it. Some people employ their handlers to do just about everything, and then they get on the back of the sled and they go. Other people, you know, use them less often. What is your rule of thumb in terms of using handlers in your kennel?
Well, I've got 30 to 35 dogs right here. They're all race-worthy this year. And basically, handler for me is somebody that's going to ride second sled, to be quite honest. These are my babies, and I'm going to be out there watching them nurture and grow. And I just want to be the one that's trying to instill the proper habits, because it's a little bit low on snow right now. As the year progresses, once we get more snow, we can set a hook in the ground. I'll start letting the handlers run 6 at a time, then maybe 8 at a time. Behind me, though, I will be going out with them just for safety concerns. The fellow I have with me this year is a little bit green. He's worked in Skagway doing the tourism the last couple of years, but, you know, running dogs in the summer is a little bit different than what the real deal is in the wintertime.
Do you guys, again, just asking for you know, kind of a long-distance musher perspective, do you guys like to have handlers that are green, or are you looking for people that are experienced? I remember last year you said on Facebook that you were looking for somebody, maybe even the year before, that you were looking for somebody to come up and work. Are you looking for somebody, you know, the college kid from Texas, or are you looking for somebody that, you know, that's kind of done that tour thing like your guy now, or is it somebody in between?
Oh, it could be anybody, really, whether you're from Texas or Argentina or, you know, Japan or what have you. A lot of it has to do with just love of the animal, I think a big turnoff for most mushers would be when a person applies for a position and the first thing they start asking about is how much money they're going to make and stuff like that. I prefer people that their first questions are about the dogs or they'd like to tell you about their love of the animals. That's what you're really looking for. You're looking for somebody that has good initiative out there, that's looking to spruce the yard up all the time and is looking, you know, like the Eric last night was just out there wandering around the yard talking and playing with dogs. And it was neat to watch, and it's good because, you know, those dogs don't know him as well as they know me. They've only known him for a few weeks. So it's good that he's getting out there and learning their names and all that. And you also want, you know, a kid that knows it's not going to be, or an older folk that knows it's not going to be that easy, that it's more than just an adventure. It's a day-to-day living with lots of responsibilities. And that, you know, all of us always have to be looking out for what's best for the dogs as far as taking care of their feet, proper stools, just right amount of food per meal, stuff like that. And it takes it's a little bit of give and take, and I have, you know, problems with being a little bit too critical of handlers, and I'm trying to work on that. But, you know, when I got into this lifestyle, I was working for three different mushers within a couple of weeks back in 95, taking care of over 200 dogs. So I went through quite the introduction to dog mushing. And I learned a lot, but I also realized a lot of the people that have, you know, been associated with me over the years had it a bit easier than I did. I had a pretty tough beginning in mushing, you know. But with a will, there's a way, and there is a beauty in being a handler because you get to go around and hopefully over a couple of years work for, I think I worked for maybe six or seven different mushers when I was handling, and you get to learn different ways of doing things because, you know, everybody has their different way of running dogs. And I wouldn't be who I was without all the handling experience I had. And I hope, even though I'm not, you know, a cream of the crop musher yet, that some of these kids that have seen my career the last 10 years have realized that with a will, there is a way. And, you know, you just got to believe in yourself and what you're about and just, you know, love the dogs. So a lot of it's just school of hard knocks. You know, you just got to learn from mistakes because not every sled run is going to be pretty out there. Just remember to hold on to that sled bar.
Well, Hugh, we have a question in our chat room for the show. I assume that they're listening live. I think they know a lot about you already. They want to know a little bit about how you ended up coming to Alaska. I know that you mentioned in the first show how you showed up to Alaska, you had a couple hundred bucks in your pocket, and you saw a movie, and the next thing you know, you wanted to be a musher. Tell our listeners, and this listener in particular doesn't have a name, it's just one of those chat room codes. What was that story that brought you up here? You know, what made that ultimate first step to go from the lower 48 up here to Alaska? What was that that bug that you caught?
It's pretty funny, man, because, you know, when I came to Alaska, I didn't even know what dog mushing was, really. I came up because I was a looper. You know, I used to be a golf caddy all the time, and the club that I worked in outside of Chicago in Wilmette, Westmoreland Country Club, I used to caddy for Bill Murray and, you know, caddy for the governor of Illinois and a few Chicago Bears football players, folks like that. Had a lot of fun there. But a buddy of mine that was also a golf caddy got a job working in Anchorage. And so he invited me to come up and visit him. And that's the first time I actually came to Alaska. I got a job working for this place out of Anchorage called Great Land Marketing. And they sent me out to this place called the Cahiltna River. And I had to help. They're setting up like a lodge for tourism and like gold panning type deal. And so they flew me out there, and I was out in this river, you know, with two ex-Vietnam vets for the summer of, I can't even remember when that was, but it was in the early 90s. And that was actually my first time in Alaska. So it wasn't until I went down to, you know, downtown Anchorage and started snooping around the stores, and then I started, you know, picking up the mushing bug, I guess you'd say. And then, of course, I started picking up literature, got a book by Lou Friedman, and just before I even fell in love with dog mushing, I was in love with Alaska more than anything, to be honest.
So you came up here in 95, is that correct?
that's when I came up finally for good. But my first year up here was like in 90, 91. I used to come up in the summers, and I did that job one summer, and then a couple other summers I worked at different fish processing plants, one over by the airport in Anchorage and then another one down in the Kenai. So it's been the story my first, you know, 3 or 4 years doing the quest and stuff. I was just roaming around from town to town or village to village, just picking up odd jobs to do while, you know, training dogs as well. So it's one thing you got to learn in life, and that was the beauty of that George Adler movie, Spirit of the Wind. He was, you know, doing dishes and stuff. You know, if you love dogs, you're going to figure out a way to pay the bills.
A lot
We're
of
always scrambling,
here.
No matter if you're a newcomer musher or a top musher, you're always trying to bring in income to help pay for, you know, a little expensive to pay for these dogs. They're not just your typical house pet.
You know, a lot of us came up here that very same way. I know that's kind of the Susan Butcher story. She came up from Colorado and you know, fell in love with the state and became a multi-Iditarod champion, as well as so many of the other guys. They just kind of wandered up here and fell in love not only with Alaska, but, of course, the sport of mushing. Do you think that that's still a realistic way of thinking to, you know, youngsters today, you know, maybe high schoolers or even, you know, kids younger than that that have that dream, that have that passion to do something, possibly dog mushing? What would you tell those kids?
It's like my buddy Curtis's wife used to tell me, Shannon, nobody gets rich in this sport, so maybe a few do, but not many. She was a sprint musher, still is. It's tough, you know. You got to do it for the lifestyle more than anything. That being said, you're going to have such a greater sense of fulfillment if you do work your way up the ranks. Then, even though I really respect a lot of these guys, like my buddy Whitey McDonald and a few other folks that have to rent dog teams because they live over in Europe or another part of the globe. If you can do the whole dream on your own without having to rent dog teams, I think your sense of fulfillment is that much greater, because you've helped you know, create and nurture this dog since it was a youngster, and you watched it grow, and you grow with the dog. That's the way I was with June Marie and Marcellus, my first couple Iditarods, and a lot of my early quest races. You're going through the experience together, and it's a tough living. But that being said, you're going to learn a lot working for a top musher for a year or two, and sometimes that's the best avenue to go.
So we're talking to Hugh Neff, the Gypsy Musher, and it's going to be the gypsymusher.com, Gypsy Musher, not the gypsymusher.com. We're on Twitter as well as Facebook. We want to do our weekly dog segment, dog profile segment. I think we need to come up with a cool name for that. But today we're going to talk about one of your dogs, Goldie. What is up with Goldie?
All right. So Goldie's a two-year-old. Her brother is Sylvester. They're both a little houndish. Her brother, or her father, Tyler, was one of my main omen's offspring, and she tends to have a little bit of his characteristics. She's a little bit reserved and shyer. She's quite finicky, so she's not going to eat kibble every time you place it in front of her. Back in the day, Charlie Boulding always would say, if a dog ain't eating, just take the food away for a day or two, and it'll learn to eat. And I'm sure that still works quite well, but with a girl like Goldie, I can tell that she just has superstar written all over. She's just all attitude and beautiful gait, and just a little young right now, but she's I let her eat as she pleases, put it that way. So she'd rather eat a chicken breast or you know, some scraps from the house. I'm gonna be a little bit nicer to her than I would to some of the another dog that, say, didn't have her, you know, she's definitely going to be quite the girl in the future. But that being said, I wouldn't do that for every dog. And she's coming around, but she just, you know, some dogs are a little bit finickier than others. That's a big part of mushing, though. You have to figure out what the dog is going to eat while it's performing. So hopefully I've been running her, you know, just as much as the other dogs, but her diet is not as much based on kibble it's more based on meats. You know, we all eat differently as well. You know, not every human likes the same foods either. So with dogs of this stature, though, I'm willing to do whatever, you know, it takes to prepare food that they're going to enjoy eating.
So how do you prepare for that on the races? If you have one or two that are really finicky eaters and they don't eat, you know, the stuff that you're preparing, what do you do at that point?
Well, I hold back those younger dogs. She was going to be a great leader, but, you know, at this age, I'm going to put her, you know, right in the middle of the team. I'm not going to have her up in front where it's going to stress her out, just because of her age more than anything. But right now, the way she eats, I won't even take her on a race, to be quite honest. I don't really necessarily need her this year. Maybe perhaps in the spring, she might be a little bit more in tune with the program. But we just, in any race, you send out a variety of foods, not only your kibble, fish, different styles of meats, you know, your beef, your chicken, your lamb, what have you. So you're always having a variety. Lance used to call it his smorgasbord. And you just figure out what they can eat on a consistent basis.
Right, right. And when you're snacking the dogs, do you use anything in particular? Do you have a special snack that you give to these guys, or just the is it just the fat or meat
no,
or fish snacks? What are you using?
Depends on weather. Typically, you know, warmer weather more like fish, colder weather more fatty stuff. I typically just soak Red Paw kibble, and they do fine on that, and it gives them tons of energy. So, like I said, you'll have a few little extra snacks on the side just in case for a dog that might be a little bit more finicky. And I have to be careful how I put the dogs in the team as well, because you don't want dogs that are going to try to steal the food from their partners. So you want dogs, if you have a bunch of dogs that are really good eaters, then it makes sort of sense to put them next to each other so they'll both eat real fast and you have to worry about them getting into each other's food.
Right. And, you know, that's a great question. I remember that came up on one of our other shows about how long you guys stop for snacks or, you know, feeding on the trails. Can you give a little bit of insight to that?
I ain't going to give too much on that one. That's all part of, you know,
that's
letting
the strategy.
Yourself out there. There's a little strategy in there. It's all about your bond with your dogs and knowing when they need a little bit longer of a rest and when they don't need as much. Obviously, all of us veteran racers, you know, when we're in checkpoints or even before the races begin, we're scouting out the weather on the internet or on TV and knowing the weather systems. And that's where it comes in handy, knowing a couple of local folks along the way as well, because they're going to tell you where the wind is and when the wind is, because a lot of parts of Alaska, there's different times of day where it's going to be more or less windy.
Right. And I know you said right before air, you have a upcoming run. It's a substantial run in terms of distance. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, I was just down in Nevada visiting my buddy Jesse, and he actually had to put in the Quest Trail one year when we were coming from Fairbanks to Whitehorse. The trail was out going into Trout Creek Cabin, and he came out from Eagle and put it in for us and sort of saved the day there. But he's a great kid, and I wish him well, and I hope he's only 29. He's originally from Alabama, and I'm hoping to see him start racing the longer races here in the next couple of years. He's been winning a lot of the shorter ones. He's just, you know, working his way up the ladder, as we all have. But he's going to hopefully visit me here in the next few weeks, and we're going to take a little run up to the village of Eagle. And Eagle is one of the most beautiful places in Alaska, and believe me, I've been to quite a few beautiful places, but there's definitely a very special feeling around Eagle. Take the Taylor Highway up there. He actually used to live on the side of American Summit back in the day, so when he sort of brought it up, and we thought it was a good idea to team up and go on a run up there. So we're going to do that. And then I have another highway, like the Taylor Highway. They're not used in the winter, so they don't plow them, so it's great for running on. And that's another highway that I'll be checking out just south of Tok as well. So it's nice to get away from the typical trails that are around the house, load the dogs up in the truck, take a little, you know, mini trip that isn't too far, and do a nice, you know, 100-mile run or thereabouts. And then when we get the Eagle, we're going to, you know, hang and visit some of the locals. Hopefully I'll be able to hook up with our buddy fellow Quest veteran Wayne Hall, and Eagle's just a real cool spot. And, you know, we're all about, you know, training and racing and all that. But when I go back to when I or why I came to Alaska, it's really all about adventure and exploring. And I never want any of these winters to be about just the same old routine, you know. You always have to try to mix things up some way.
And how long are these runs going to be? You said it's about 100 miles. How long is that in terms of time this early in the season?
I'm not totally positive on the mileage there, but it really depends on how much of the road is still being used by snow machine traffic or truck traffic. So we're just going to drive up the highway a little bit, and then when the snow gets to be at a respectable level, that's what we'll start at. But as far as run time goes, it depends on whether we decide to take a, you know, couple-hour layover. But I would say it's at least 10 to 15 hours, somewhere in there. But a lot of these younger dogs, you know, this will be their first experience going on an adventure of this capacity. So I want to make it fun for them. We're not going to be out there, you know, trying to set any speed records or anything. And a lot of these dogs that I'm training right now, not a lot of them, but at least a half dozen of them, they're really not even going to race at all this year. I'm just giving them good training for the following year. They're two-year-olds that I can sort of tell just by the makeup of their body and how they compare to my veterans that are a lot more thickened in and a lot harder, that they wouldn't be able to keep up with their pace over the long haul. But that doesn't mean I can't train them right now in hopes that they'll be ready next year. You're always keeping an eye on the future.
You said earlier that Eagle is one of the most beautiful spots in Alaska, and I know that mushers congregate to particular areas, whether it's, you know, out your way in Tok, or, you know, where John Baker lives out there. I guess that would be western Alaska. Where are some other places that mushers, whether they're distance, sprint, or even, you know, just your mix of all, where are some of the spots in Alaska where people are congregating as mushers?
Well, where I'm at in Tok is actually primarily sprint mushers. As far as doing trips like going to Eagle, the only fellow I know that used to train on the Taylor Highway was a guy that I highly respect. That's Sonny Linder. So I don't necessarily want to be going and hanging out where there's a bunch of other mushers. I think we're all, as mushers, we enjoy when we got the whole space to ourselves, you know. But typically the White Mountains, just north of Fairbanks, that's where a lot of your folks are going to train, or in Two Rivers, the Wasilla area down by Kinnick, the Reddingtons, out in Big Lake, you have Martin and Jake and a whole crew of people. So there's Willow, of course, you have Dee Dee and Vern and everyone. So there's just people are spread out all over the place. Besides Eagle, the other big training run that we'll be hoping to do here in early December, we'll be heading up to my buddy Brent Sass's in Eureka, where Susan Butcher used to train out of with her partner Dave Monson. And Brent and I are going to hopefully get a few other mushers, and we're going to head up to Tanana to visit where I used to live, Lester Earhart's. And we're hoping to put together a little fun little race that's not super serious, but there will be some prizes involved. Because, you know, you get a few mushers together, you might as well throw a wager or two down. But those two runs, I think, will be plenty as far as getting the dog team hardened in. Even though I'm training over 30 dogs right now, I already have most of the starting team from last year coming back, so I don't really have to worry about training them up too much.
You know, I know a lot of the Iditarod guys still do a lot of the mid-distance races, I assume, to get their dogs ready for the big race, the Iditarod or the Quest. Is that still in your profile, or have you gone away from that a bit?
Oh, I used to do those races for training runs, to be honest. I figure, oh, time to go do the Copper Basin and train up the dogs. Then I learned over the years that if you're going to go race, you should show up with a team that's already trained. I definitely prefer to do races that are in the villages. As I've stated before, I'm sort of a native wannabe, and I love getting out there and visiting with friends in like the Klykas and all the folks up there in Bethel doing the Cusco and, you know, getting to hang out with John and Mitch and Jeff and whoever decides to come there. That's a very difficult race, not for your novice musher by any means. Difficult trail, difficult weather conditions. But that's where you really learn about a lot about who you are. And a race like that, though, if you push your team too hard, might not necessarily be good for you in the longer, you know, races. So depends on what you're more interested in doing, making money immediately and trying to win that race, the 300-miler or the 200-miler, or are you trying to get your team more fine-tuned for the longer race. I usually play it by ear. If I'm looking good in a mid-distance race, then maybe I'll try to, you know, keep the dogs going good and maybe push them a little bit. But if, you know, you're not in the top three in any race, really, there's no reason to push the dogs too hard because, you know, it's not going to really be that big a deal whether, to me personally, whether you finish fourth or fifth or 10th or 11th. What's, you know, a lot of people like to race against the people that are around them. That's what they get off on, but that's really not what dog mushing is to me at all, unless you're going for the trophy or whatever.
Right, right. So we have about 10 minutes left, Hugh. I know we want to talk a little bit about your school tour. We've promoted it on the last couple of shows. Anything else you want to mention today today I'm trying to focus a little bit on the new guys. I got a couple of questions on Facebook that I've posed to you already today about, you know, just that lifestyle that you're leading that a lot of people down in the States, whether they're just weekend warrior mushers or guys that, you know, have dreams of doing Iditarod or Quest or Copper Basin or whatever. What can you tell some of these guys that just haven't took the next step yet? And the next step isn't necessarily moving to Alaska, but just becoming enthralled with the dogs.
First of all, you have to learn to be cheap. I hate to say it, but a lot of people think QNF's this rich kid from Chicago, but they don't realize that I shop at Salvation Army and I barely eat it all. You know, all your income and all your finances should be directed around your dogs and what's best for them solely. You know, people who have dogs and then, you know, do a 10-mile run and then go out to the bars and tell everybody how great their dog teams are, they usually don't make it very far in this world. So you have to believe in your dogs. Try to live a fairly simple life if you can. Don't get too many dogs right away. Try to keep it small. I'm at 35 right now here in Token. That's perfect. I can spend a lot of attention on each dog, and they get a lot of time each day to play and, you know, hang out with each other, which is great. So I like to keep a fairly mellow yard. Once you get too many dogs, then it becomes more like a corporate musher than what I'm looking to be. And I would always want to try to keep it as small as I can. Numbers-wise, just have to have that passion is what it's all about. That being said, if you talk to most of my folks that I've been, you know, competing with over the last decade, if you ask them about QNF, they'd all probably say that he's a little bit crazy in the head. But you know what? I might be crazy in the head, but I sure get to see a lot of beautiful sights and spend a lot of you know, time with some amazing animals and visit a lot of cool people too. So you just have to set out a plan and don't think it's all going to happen all at once. It's usually going to take a few years for things to come together. And, you know, just learn from your experiences. You have to want to evolve too. No matter if you're a new musher, if you're the number one guy on the block, you should always be seeking to try to figure out a way to do it a little bit better each day.
So it is possible for those guys that aren't quite ready to take the step to, like you said, it's just something that you have to be meticulous about. You have to have that passion. You have to have focus. Is that correct?
Yeah, and if you're going to go work for another musher as a handler, if you have a great work ethic and you're out there, you know, busting it every day for that guy or gal, they're more than likely going to go, you know what, this person deserves to do a race, whether it's a 100-mile race or the Copper Basin. And look at a guy like Brent. He had Kyla with him, and she did the Quest last year. And she signed up to do it again because Brent knows that he's got a good, great handler there, and they're good partners as far as keeping the kennel running. So a lot of it's just, you know, that's the beauty of Alaska. You know this. It's all about having a good work attitude. And up here, if you like manual labor and you like getting a little bit sweaty each day, you can go places.
Right, right. And, yeah, I can attest to that. This morning we're down there building dog houses, and we're getting ready to do our little run here this afternoon. And like you said, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's something you have to be passionate about. It's something you have to want to do every day. But there's no greater feeling in the world than waking up and doing what you love. Isn't that right, Hugh?
Yeah, I'd love to put like a little time-lapse video of me in the dog yard. I think people will get a chuckle about it because half the time I'm just walking around in circles, and I often wonder if I was a lot more mellow of a person before I became a musher, because a lot of your mushers are really sort of hyper personalities because they just got a lot going on, and not only in their dog mushing world but in their regular lives too. And we're just always running around in circles because we've got so much to do on our list each day. But that's the beauty of it. You know, we keeps you out of trouble, and it keeps you you have a smile each day because you enjoy what you're doing.
Well, you know, I think people are enjoying this show, Hugh. We've increased in our listeners every week, and the more that people hear about it and listen to it, I think we're going to be able to provide those little bit of nuggets and those stories along the trail as we go. It's still very early in the season, and I know things are going to start getting hectic as all of us start doing a little bit longer runs and spending more time on the trail, but that's what it's all about. Hugh, about 3 minutes left. Do you want to say anything about your school tours before we go?
Oh, first thing I want to tell you, man, I was thinking about it earlier today on the run. We've got pretty good cell reception once I get away from the dog kennel there. So I'm going to play with it this week, but hopefully within maybe the next show or the one after that, I was thinking it'd be sort of neat to actually do a show where I'm actually on the dog sled on
the
trail.
Awesome. Yeah, that would be great.
So I'm going to look into it this week, man, and I think that would be pretty cool if we can set that up for next week's show. The tour, I got 4 shows in Rapid City the week before Christmas. Then I'm heading through Minneapolis. I got a date still available there if any school or group would enjoy a show. Then I'm heading up towards Duluth to do a show or two. And then I have a couple shows over in western Wisconsin, just over by La Crosse, hopefully, that will be coming together here soon. And I will be in the Milwaukee area and northern Chicago area right around the holidays as well. So looking to get out there and, you know, not promote Hugh Neff. I think a lot of people might look at me and think I'm just being a blowhard and trying to talk about myself all the time, but I'm really trying to help educate folks, give them incentive to achieve their dreams. And, you know, Joe Reddington was my hero, so I just want to get out there and be like him and promote the heck out of this sport. And hopefully the more education we get out there, the more fans around the world will gravitate towards this amazing lifestyle that I think you see it on TV nowadays with Alaska. So many people realize why we live up here now. It's not because we're crazy. It's because we're in love with Alaska more than anything.
That's exactly right. And I know you do a big school tour in May after the mushing season's over and things have calmed down, at least on that front. You're out all over the place on the East Coast as well. You can find out more information about that by following Hugh on Facebook or visiting his website. Right now it's laughingeyeskennel.com. Hugh, we got about a minute to go. I'm going to let you go. Next week will be the same time, 4 o'clock Alaska time. That is 8 o'clock Eastern. But you can follow us anytime on iTunes or on blogtalkradio.com/dogworks. And we do welcome your questions and comments. You can send them to anybody, whether it's me or Hugh, or get on that chat room here on the show sometime, and we'll be happy to forward those questions along. So, Hugh, until next week, we'll talk to you again, okay?
Have a good one, man, and enjoy your dogs.
Thank you very much. This is Robert Forto on behalf of our co-host, the Gypsy Musher, Hugh Neff, Iditarod, and Yukon Quest veteran. Until next week, we will see you guys next time. Goodbye.